It's more than just curiosity that keeps drawing John Cahey back to his favorite island in the Mediterranean.
Sitting on a bench in a small town, engaging in conversation, and then all of a sudden that leads to friendships and future visits.
In a moment, we'll hear how lifelong learning can turn into many repeat visits to Sicily. As a frequent rail commuter to Milan, newspaper columnist Beppe Severnini has noticed that a lot can happen on a train trip, especially a long one.
Lots of books and revelations and marriages and commitments actually were born during train travel.
He explains why he prefers to travel by train whenever possible. While photojournalist Greta Rebus tells us how visiting hot springs all over the world can also be a revelation.
Geothermal water is groundwater that has gone on a bit of a journey.
Let's share the ride together for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. As a photographer, Greta Rebus loves how much variety there is to hot springs all around the world. In just a bit, she shares a few of her favorites with tips on how to make yourself comfortable soaking with strangers anywhere. And one of Italy's top newspaper columnists shares his observations on the benefits of traveling by train. Beppe Severnini says the entertainment value of the people you meet is a big part of it. A retired newspaperman from Salt Lake City starts us out on today's Travel with Rick Steves, telling us why he finds himself returning to Sicily over and over again. The island of Sicily, while nominally a region of Italy, is really a world apart. Sitting at the toe of Italy's boot, in the middle of the Mediterranean, it's seen wave after wave of conquerors, and this complicated past makes it distinct. It's got spicier food, it's got a more festive lifestyle, it's got people who are Sicilian first and Italian second. Author John Cahey has been traveling to Italy for decades and written two books about Sicily since retiring as a newspaper journalist back in 2011. The books are Seeking Sicily and Sicilian Splendors, and he's joining us today to talk about the art of savoring the charms of Sicily. John, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, now, you wrote that having had no known ancestry there, Italy and Sicily keep summoning me. What is it about Sicily that would summon you if you don't have Sicilian roots?
I have to say that it's the people. I mean, the ancient history, of course, is fascinating, and I'm an amateur historian, so I read a lot about that. But it's the people, and I've ended up, after several trips to Sicily, I've got friends on that island that are a joy to have. People that I've just met, come across accidentally, talk to, sitting on a bench in a small town, engaging in conversation, and then all of a sudden that leads to friendships and future visits.
You know, that is so interesting you say that, John, because I've been traveling a lot all over Europe, and I've traveled to a lot of countries quite extensively, but there's no country in Europe where I know so many names and where I understand the social design of a little town. After enough visits, I learn who's the character, who's the problem, who's the hero, who's the caretaker. You know about this fascinating festival of life. And even as a traveler, you can be welcome into that scene, can't you?
Yes. Every time I go to a new Airbnb, for example, I will always send a message before I get there to the owner. And I'll say, do you know someone who is an expert on XYZ? And they almost always do. And they will, as soon as I get there, they will introduce me and we'll have a meal.
Ah.
And they will take the next day and they will show me here and there and they'll take me around. And we become friends. And that happened in a whole bunch of the books I've written.
That's a great tip. And I know from trying to write a good book, those are the moments that you get out your notepad and that are very, very fertile for getting that content that you want to weave into your book. You wrote about a coffee bar, a favorite coffee bar in Racconmuto. Can you tell us about why that was particularly memorable?
Well, I had been in Racconmuto two or three times for various reasons, and it was just always a nice stop along the way to somewhere else. And one time, there was a gentleman who, for some reason, just approached me on the street and introduced himself, and he recognized me as a tourist. He wanted to know where I was from, and he spoke decent English, and I spoke a little basic Italian, so we got along just fine. And about 2 years later, I'm back again, And I go into this place that I had frequented often. It was a nice little restaurant, some of the best food that I had had in Sicily. And he was sitting across the room. I immediately recognized him, didn't remember his name. And he looked up, saw me walk through the door, and he said, "John Cahey, you're back."
Yeah. Wow.
And I loved it. It was, I mean, yeah. We sat and we had a great conversation again. And I've seen him a couple of times in trips.
See,
there.
You have a knack for connecting with the locals. And that's a more important knack when it comes to enjoying a country than knowing what's in the museums, I think. I mean, looking through both, you've written two books, Seeking Sicily and Sicilian Splendors. And if you didn't have that knack for meeting people, they would be really short books. These are rich books. I'm filled with experiences you had with meeting people. I always remind people, you know, if you like Italy as far south as Rome, go further south because it gets better. If Italy's getting on your nerves by the time you get to Rome, don't go further south because it gets worse. It intensifies. And when you get down to Sicily, you've got Italy in the extreme, and it's more important than ever to be able to tap into that people-to-people dimension of travel. One thing I like to say, I've said it for years in my lectures, if you see four old guys sitting on a bench, ask them to scoot over. You got to join them, don't you?
Yeah, I remember one experience in Acitrezza, which is one of my favorite places to go to on the Ionian Sea, on the east coast, north of Catania. And there was this little square that I would sit in every afternoon. And I went there, and all the benches were taken, except there was this one spot next to these gentlemen. Mm-hmm. And I asked if I could have it, and they said, "No, we're saving it for a friend of ours." Soon this old man was led by, I assume, a grandson over to that seat, and that's who they were waiting for. And he was sitting there for a while, and then he got up and left, and one of those gentlemen walked over, tapped me on the shoulder, and said, "You can sit there now."
Ah.
And we had this wonderful conversation. It was struggling because they only spoke Sicilian dialect, and it was difficult, but we made each other's acquaintance, and that's the beauty of it all.
It sure is. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with John Cahey. He's collected his favorite places and experiences from Sicily in his books. He's written Sicilian Splendors and Seeking Sicily. You can find out more about John and listen to his previous interview about retracing the routes of ancient Roman roads from Rome to Istanbul with this week's show details at ricksteves.com/radio. John, tell me about the charms of Sicily as opposed to Italy. I mean, it's part of Italy technically, but it's certainly its own culture and its own way of life. What are the charms of Sicily?
You know, I've always made the distinction. When I write, I try to make the distinction between southern Italy and the island of Sicily, because Sicily is a world apart.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel more relaxed in southern Italy and Sicily, but especially Sicily, because now that there was a time, and I think in long ago memory, when Sicily was kind of a closed place because of the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
People did not welcome outsiders. Well, that's all changed. The island has opened up.
Mm-hmm.
People are reacting to that mafia heritage, which of course still exists under the surface and will probably always still exist under the surface.
Yeah, but the mafia, it kind of goes back to a Robin Hood kind of situation against bad foreign governments, I think.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of colonial powers would take over Sicily, and the mafia would have their way with law and order, but they would win the support of the villagers by standing up against the government. And then rural Sicilians, I understand, kind of relied on the mafia rather than the police to settle disputes. But, of course, it's been a brutal kind of story. What's the latest with the mafia today? Are they still a force?
They're very much under the radar.
Right.
And I had an experience where there was a favorite restaurant in Palermo that I had eaten in several times. And it was really quite a small place. And then on a subsequent trip, he had expanded and it was beautifully redesigned and the food was still excellent. And I went back on one of my last trips, and the place was closed. The authorities had come in, closed it down, because this gentleman apparently had used mafia money for his remodeling and so on to make the place beautiful. And to my knowledge, it is still closed down. Interestingly, it's in a square of Via Domenica, which has a church in it that has the remains of Falcone, who was killed by the mafia in the early 90s.
Oh, yeah.
When they killed those two justices,
that was it.
That was the beginning of Sicilians' willingness to come out and talk about it.
Yeah. Since retirement, John Cahey has written a number of books about his love for Sicily and other parts of Italy. You can find his work at johncahey.com, and that's spelled K-E-A-H-E-Y. Well, one thing about Sicily that I think is thriving is the cuisine. You write about the food in your book. You had one particularly fine dining experience in a place called Cimina.
It's interesting. I have a friend who is a Sicilian-American, and she said, go see Cimina. That's her ancestral village.
Yeah.
And I showed up in Cimina. It was around 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday, and I went into this shop, and I said, is there a nice restaurant around that you would recommend? And he said, it's up on the hill. He says, go up there. And this other fellow in the shop said, I'm driving by there right now. Follow me in your car. And so we got all the way up there, a road that overlooked the town, and went into this place. And the guy said to the man, he said, this is a tourist, and he wants a good meal, and we recommended you. And they started bringing out food, no menu, one appetizer after the other. And then they bring out the main course, and they just come out one after the other.
I love that.
And then they come out with the salad. You always had the salad after the main course in Sicily. And this experience of sitting there for about 2 hours, eating one thing after another, I'm not a heavy eater, but I devoured everything.
But you're probably lucky that man sets you up. And he said, this is a tourist. Take good care of him.
Right. And he knew nothing about me being a writer.
Yeah.
It was just somebody to come in.
Well, you wrote about it quite vividly in your book. Hey, we're out of time, but there's three sort of iconic things in my mind about Sicily. The Greek ruins, the church heritage, and the colorful, boisterous marketplaces. I'd like just your take on whatever you'd like to finish it about the quintessence of Sicily.
Well, the thing I've said about the Greeks is that there are more Greek ruins in Sicily, I think. I've never counted or anything like that, but I believe there are more Greek ruins in Sicily than there are in Greece, and they are well cared for in Sicily. And I tend to want to wander just through them and maybe have a conversation with somebody behind the counter.
You know, I think one thing for us to remember is 500 years before Christ, southern Italy was called Magna Graecia, Greater Greece. And there's a lot of wonderful Greek ruins in southern Italy, and the best of them would be in Sicily. Hey, John, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on your books, Seeking Sicily and Sicilian Splendors. You've been an inspiration for a lot of people to a wonderful corner of Europe. Thanks so much, and, mille grazie.
Hey, buon viaggio.
A popular columnist for one of Italy's biggest newspapers is back with us in a minute on Travel with Rick Steves. Beppe Severnini points out the entertainment value of passenger trains as a fun way to experience the world. And later in the hour, we'll help you unwind at some of the world's most photogenic hot springs. Italian journalist Beppe Severnini is a self-proclaimed train buff. He's traveled around the world by train in installments, each trip a revelation. He's viewed Europe, Asia, Australia, and the U.S. all by rail. He even honeymooned on the Trans-Siberian Express, a six-day trip through six time zones in second class and sharing the compartment with two strangers. Talk about romantic. He's documented this journey and many others in his book, Off the Rails, A Train Trip Through Life. He joins us now to tell us what riding the rails can teach us about a nation's culture and ourselves. Ciao, Beppe.
Ciao, Rick. Lovely to hear from you.
Wow, I love trains and you love trains and you've traveled the world in installments. I love that idea that each segment or trip is a revelation. You know, you wrote a book about it. You collected your favorite train experiences. In general, how is a train trip a revelation?
Well, let me do something that I don't normally do, sort of read from my books, just a few lines, because they give you, you know, it's the very beginning of my Off the Rails book, and just a few lines. Travel in general, and train travel in particular, is an opportunity to think, sum up, confront ideas, but it is especially a way to understand what we're like and what we've become. We and the world around us. That's the point. I mean, you can think when you travel by train. Someone else is driving. That's the bottom line. You can relax and you can read a book. You can talk to other people. You can watch the landscape. But you can think about yourself. I think lots of books and revelations and marriages and commitments actually were born during train travel. I'm absolutely convinced. Even on Amtrak, because it takes longer.
I think that we need to remember that when we do commit ourselves to a long train ride, that the ride itself can be a reason for the journey. One of my favorite examples from your book is the journey that you took across America with your 20-year-old son at the time, 5,000 miles, part car, part bus, but mostly by train, from Washington, D.C. to the state of Washington. And you mentioned your son, Antonio. It was a gift of mutual and personal discovery that Antonio chose to bestow on you. It was like an opportunity as a father to be sharing this experience with your son. What made this, of all your journeys, the most stirring journey?
Well, it's very generous from a 20-year-old son to spend almost a month with you, because we went south from Washington, D.C., we went to Georgia, then we went to Louisiana, then we went to Texas, then to the bottom of California, and then up. So it really took a long time. And he decided to spend it with me. And I really invite all of our listeners, fathers, do travel with your son once a year. It could be one day, can be a weekend, or once in a lifetime, as I've done, take a long train trip. And if I may, even mothers with your daughters, at 20 years old, wouldn't dream of going with his parents or her parents.
Actually, I haven't even thought about this before, but my father had a ritual called a sneakaway. And once a year, he would wake me up while it was still dark, and he'd say, "Son, let's go." And we would go, and my mom wouldn't even know where we were going. We would call her at breakfast time 2 hours later, and we would go somewhere on a hike or camping just for a day trip. But those were magic moments for me. It wasn't a big deal. You didn't need a passport. It was just time away together. And you had the luxury of that with your son.
I'm glad, Rick, I brought that memory back for you, because I've been doing that with my son. Maybe a football match, maybe bought two motorcycles going around. But that journey, the one that opens the book, is actually the most interesting.
Oh, yeah. Now, fundamental to the good experience is meeting people. And that's a common thread through all of your articles, is the people you meet. And you need to make a point to meet people. I mean, I remember in your book, you were on the train ride from Naples to London, and you actually had a bobblehead of Trump that you put out on the train car so that people would want apparently so people could talk politics with you. If you have that bobblehead of Trump, people are going to kind of go, "Hey, what's with that?" And it's going to open up doors that you would never have opened up.
I know it sounds absolutely crazy, but trust me, I didn't say anything. I just boarded a train in Naples, put my bobblehead Trump in front of me and said nothing. And all the way from Naples to London, that it takes 3 days, people would come and give me their view about America, about Donald Trump. And I was listening. It was fantastic.
Fascinating. You could take notes, and you're a journalist. You could get a whole fascinating essay out of comments from people passing me by in the train when they see my bobblehead Trump.
Yes, it's in the book. And, you know, bobblehead Trump has an advantage that he doesn't speak, he doesn't tweet at night, he's quiet, the bobblehead.
As a tour operator, you know, I've got a lot of guides that work with me, and they also work with other companies in Europe. And the standard wisdom for tour guides in Europe is don't talk about politics, don't talk about religion, and don't talk about soccer.
They are the most interesting things in life, and including sex. So talk about everything, all of those things when you travel by train is going to be fun.
Politics, religion, sex, and soccer. Talk about it.
Absolutely.
You know, share respectfully. And when you're on a train, you have a royal opportunity. I remember as a kid backpacking around Europe with my year rail pass. Every time I had a picnic, I knew other people on the compartment would have a picnic also. And if I offered them some of my strawberries, suddenly the picnic becomes a food festival. And it's just a perfect opportunity. But we have to break the ice. You have to take the initiative to connect and to remind everybody, hey, we're all bored. We're all interesting. We're all in this compartment. Let's talk.
Of course, talk show, you know, the television format, the talk shows were invented on trains. Trains are traveling talk shows, free. You can be a guest, you can be the star, you can be quiet and watch the other people, but it's like a theater and a talk show all combined, the price of the ticket.
And you have an opportunity to contribute to peace and understanding in this world. I was just in Oslo 2 weeks ago in front of the Nobel Peace Prize Center. There's a curved bench. It's a bench that is like the shape of a semicircle. And it's a bench, and you can't sit on it without falling to the middle and being close to the people you're sitting with. And then there's a quote by Nelson Mandela saying, talking to each other is the greatest weapon for peace. And this is the peace bench. And when you're on a train, it's like you are falling together, you have to talk to each other, and you can do that. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Beppe Serenini, and his book is called Off the Rails, A Train Trip Through Life. And it's a collection of his basically epic train trips through his life. And Beppe, you call it Off the Rails. What's the backstory of the book's title, Off the Rails?
Oh, actually, it was the publisher who picked it, because the Italian title was completely different, and I liked it. I know what Off the Rails means. There is an element of off the beaten track and balance, right, in the word off the rails.
To me, it means you've lost your original plan and everything is going crazy, but you're going to ride it out and make the best of it.
That's it. That's why I liked it. But it's something also my stories are coming off the rails, because I describe my journey. Some of them are now all like the last summer of communists back in 1989, taking a train in Helsinki and trying to get to Istanbul, Turkey, through the communist country at the time. It was like epic with my very young wife at the time. Crossing America from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon. That's another journey I took by
train. I want to talk about this one on the last year of communism, because I was doing a lot of traveling back then too. That would have been in the late 80s or something. And I'm nostalgic about borders. And today, it seems like where there's less borders, countries are communicating and there's less stress. And when there's more borders, that's when things are falling apart and we have to have more walls instead of bridges. And back then, there were a lot of borders, weren't there? Going through border formalities was a big part of the journey. I almost measured how far it was to the destination by how many borders I had to cross.
Absolutely. I'm glad borders have gone. In Europe, most of them have gone. You can travel from Norway or Sweden and go to Sicily without actually being stopped at the border.
That's a really
good thing. But I have to say that we are more or less the same age, Rick. And when we were young, I think borders were part of the excitement. As a 20-something, you know, it's like an obstacle, something you go through, you know, is a challenge, an obstacle, an uncertainty. Yeah. You need those when you are 22.
Yeah. You do, but you don't. Yeah, but we know now, as people who want the world to live together peacefully, less borders is a very good sign. When I was thinking about my days of traveling through the Warsaw Pact and the former Soviet Union, vodka had a lot to do with it. Do you have any stories about hard liquor on a train ride and aggressive friendships?
Oh, yes, especially in Poland. I was traveling across Poland. When I was coming from Leningrad across Poland, I crossed Poland two or three times, and I remember, you know, being challenged by a group of miners, very friendly, from Katowice or Zabrze. Oh, come on, you know, challenge. Let's drink together. Yeah. I'll say, we have a problem. I'm not very good at holding alcohol.
Let's drink. That's the most frightening thing for me. If I'm on a train in Russia and there's three guys that look like they're looking for their soccer team, you know, or maybe they're going to military camp. And they say, let's drink. And I go, you can't say no. And you know, if you say yes, you're going to go somewhere where you're going to be less in control. And it's quite forceful.
You must find a pot plant and poison that with, I'm afraid, poor pot plant and pour the vodka there once in every other vodka you put it there. Otherwise, you have a real problem.
Yeah. and they'd still drink me under the table or under the bench. One of my favorite thoughts about train travel is romance on the rails. And I was reading some of your stories, and I just remembered way back in the days of communism, under a full moon, standing in the aisle of the train going from Prague to Budapest, and just standing there and getting to know the woman next to me. And it was just one of the most curiously romantic times I've ever had. Was just, you know how the window of the train, the old trains would pull down and it would be dusty and everything, but when you pulled the window down, it was just perfect view, brilliant, clean, the twinkling stars and the rhythm of the rails, and talking with somebody from far away and just exploring life together. One of the magical things. Tell me about romance on trains for you.
I open the book with a phrase by an old traveler that wrote under different name. This one is Valérie Larbeau. I read it to you. I felt for the first time all the sweetness of life in the compartment of the North Express between Verbalen and Pskov. The sweetness of life experienced on a train is something, an experience that you just described, Rick, that in this old traveler 100 years ago experienced. And I have two. And there is a lot. Graham Greene, Agatha Christie wrote about romance on the train. Mine was very special because I took my wife on our honeymoon from Moscow to Beijing on the Trans-Siberian when the Soviet Union was there. So it was pretty challenging, trust me. Also because I happened to find two other girls in the compartment and they were not. That was a bit of a surprise. If you want to know what happened, I can tell you.
So let me just set this up because I really enjoyed this chapter. We're talking, by the way, with Beppe Severnini. His book is called Off the Rails, A Train Trip Through Life. Talking about the epic train rides he's had over the decades. And apparently, on your honeymoon, you had booked a nicer compartment for two for this six-day through six time zones, 5,600-mile trip across Russia. Something happened, as happens on train rides, and the reservation got mixed up. So you ended up not only with miserable food and the most simple of hygiene, but you had to share the compartment with two strangers. And this was after you're married. I thought that'd be a grueling test that might be smarter before you're married, but you did this after you're married. Tell us more what happened and how that journey turned out.
Well, it was actually a few days after we were married, and I entered this compartment in Moscow, and the Soviet Union is there. It's not that you just go out, okay, I send an email and correct this, please. You know, the Soviet Union, you're talking about the 1980s, they couldn't care less. And those girls happened to be Russians. They were both called Lyuba, and they immediately realized what had happened. These poor bastards, you know, there's two Italians on their honeymoon. We are sharing
on
it.
On your honeymoon.
Sharing. And so I told my wife was a little perplexed, and I told my wife, let's see what we can do. And those girls were so nice, this Lyuba and Lyuba. Yeah. One was kind of younger, one was a little older. And around, you know, it takes 6 days, 6 nights, a long, long journey. And around 6 in the afternoon, sort of 6 in the evening, the younger Lyuba, will tell the other Lyuba in English so we could understand. Lyuba, why don't we go for a walk? And the other would say, yes, Lyuba, and we'll be away for at least half an hour. So those poor bastards can have, you know, it's a honeymoon, for God's sake, you know. And when they left the compartment, Hortensia and I were still married happily. We sex? Of course not. We laughed for half an hour because the situation was so absurd, but it was lovely. And my final words, they are in the books, in Off the Rails, that if your wife smiles in a situation like that, in the Moscow station, is the Yaroslavsky Moscow station, and still smiles after 6 days in Beijing Central Station, you married the right woman. And I have.
And how many years ago was that?
37.
And you're still together?
Absolutely. Grandparents.
And now you've got a grandson who you can look forward to taking on train rides.
Yes, Agatha. Well, Agatha,
oh,
that's her name.
A granddaughter.
She'll probably run the train because she's a bossy, very... She's 17 months, but I could see her bossing the bosses in Russia.
Beppe Severnini is with us from his home studio in Crema, just outside Milan. where he's an editor and columnist at Italy's largest circulation daily newspaper. We're celebrating the value of travel by train right now, which Beppe explores in his 2019 book, Off the Rails, A Train Trip Through Life. Beppe Severnini, so fun to talk to you. You know, we've both got this, we're from the same generation where the year rail pass has a nostalgic meaning from a day when that was the way we traveled around. And it's great to celebrate the beauty of train travel. The book is called Off the Rails, A Train Trip Through Life. And Beppe, you talk about train tracks like closing a zipper. Tell us how train tracks are like closing a zipper.
The word is wide, the word is open, the word is complicated, the word is can be scaring. And you close a zipper because the line, you know, the tracks are a straight line like a zipper. And you take the train and you close that zipper and somehow you create an order of some kind, mentally as well, because you go from point A to point B, you go from Moscow to Beijing, you go to Portland, Maine, to Portland, Oregon, and you look and you say, okay, of the word is complicated, the word is wide, the word is diverse, but at least I found some kind of order here, and I follow that order, I follow that, and I learned something. It's a time in life and in space and in time, but that is my time and my space.
And Beppe, to be able to talk with you about train travel live from Northern Italy to our studio here in Seattle, and to do it with the sound of your town's church bells accompanying us, it's just a reminder that the world's a beautiful place for us to explore, and when we do it, we need to do it in a way where we connect. Thank you so much, Beppe, and it must be a delight to have church bells out your window.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Ciao, grazie. Beppe Severnini's books include an international bestseller called Ciao America, An Italian Discovers the U.S. And he examines how Italian culture and character were tested by the COVID pandemic in Italian Lessons, 50 Things We Know About Life Now. You can listen to Beppe's earlier appearances with us with the shortcuts we provide at this week's show. It's at ricksteves.com/radio. Ready for a good long soak? A photojournalist takes us to her favorite hot springs around the world. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. Photographer Greta Rivas has always had a hot spot for warm water. Growing up in Idaho, she learned to swim in a hot springs pool. And later, when her family moved to Japan, they made regular use of the local community baths. Several years ago, she set out to document how people around the world use thermal waters and hot springs. The result is a stunning and evocative book detailing the unique topographies, regional uses, and cultural meanings of 23 different hot springs in 12 countries. The book's called Hot Springs, Photos and Stories of How the World Soaks, Swims, and Slows Down. Greta's joining us today from her home in Maine to share her fascination with what she calls earthly riots and unexpected geological twists. Greta, thanks so much for joining us.
Rick, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, this is, you know, a lot of people encounter a lot of hot springs in their travels, and they could appreciate a little bit of context. And your book is a great way to get the big picture about what hot springs are all about. And you started off by mentioning that the world's first official national park was because of hot water.
Yeah, Yellowstone National Park was established partially to protect the natural wonders of Yellowstone, including hot springs. And so a lot of what I was fascinated by with this book was the different ways that people used and enjoyed and protected hot water. This one natural phenomena that emerges from the earth in what feels like a million different ways, a million different colors, temperatures, and then so many different ways that human beings take that natural phenomena and enjoy it.
And it occurred to me, we just turn on the hot shower now or fill up our hot tubs now, and we don't even think twice about where does the heat come from. But back in 1872, when President Ulysses S. Grant founded the first national park, hot water, wow, was a big deal. And reading through your book, in all these corners of the planet, I kept imagining most of these thermal springs were appreciated before there was electricity. And
yeah,
hot water was must have been a marvel.
I thought about that so much. In one hot spring in Greenland,
the structure of the hot spring, like a very simple natural pool, had been built thousands of years ago, likely by the Norse. And so you could be soaking in a hot bath used by people thousands of years ago, and just thinking about how harsh that life might have been, and what a joy and an anomaly it must have been to even experience the feeling of being submerged in hot water.
You know, Greta, I was just in Iceland, you know, and I've been up in Scandinavia lately, and I just think, whoa, imagine the days when you had no relief from the cold, and your world was just a soggy, wet, dark, you know, dark blanket.
Yeah.
And then you plop into this magically hot thermal pool. You just go, whoa, which one of the gods gave this to me, and what do I do to get more of it?
I know. And I think one of the things that I love about hot springs so much is it is easy to take for granted how miraculous nature is. And to be literally immersed in it, to just be sitting in a bit of a wonder of nature, it's so invigorating and restful at the same time. And each little corner of the globe has its own feeling. And I especially find that in hot springs. You can go in the water and it might have a different viscosity or color, or it might feel different to the skin. And paying attention to this type of feeling of being in nature is something that I love so much about being a person alive on this planet, but I especially feel it in hot springs.
You know, when we think about this wonder of hot springs, Greta, I noticed your parents, you mentioned in the introduction, honeymooned in hot springs. So did my parents. I mean, and I thought, whoa, we've got something in common here. Our families appreciate hot springs. My parents honeymooned in Harrison Hot Springs up in Banff and Jasper in Canada. And then also we both grew up with hot springs, you in the Rockies and me in the Olympics. I remember when I was a kid, we'd vacation at the Olympic Hot Springs and we'd go hiking to the next hot springs. So we grew up and tuned into that. And I suppose that gave you a predisposition to being on the lookout for hot springs. And in your book, by the way, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Greta Rebus, and her book is Hot Springs, Photos and Stories of How the World Soaks, Swims, and Slows Down. Greta's a photojournalist who specializes in documenting human connections to the natural world. Her website is gretarebus.com, and that's R-Y-B-U-S. Greta, as I enjoyed your book, the photography was just gorgeous. You've collected a wonderful variety of hot springs. I love this idea that some of them look like palaces, others like a hole in the ground, some of them feel like a party, and others feel like a prayer. Let's talk about these. Tell me about a hot springs that strikes you as a palace.
Gellert Hot Spring in Budapest. Mm. Oh my gosh. I walked in and I did not expect to be moved to the degree that I was by Gellert. It is just beautifully mosaic. The light filters into the space through these upper domed skylights. And what's fascinating about it is it feels like a palace, but it's used by a lot of local people as part of their daily routine or part of a medical treatment prescribed by doctors. And I think I was so moved by how beautiful this space was, but it was still designed to serve a utility for the public.
You know, that is interesting because anybody that goes to Budapest is finding that the thermal baths there are like number one on your sightseeing list. And I like to think of soaking in a thermal bath as a great equalizer. I was in Iceland soaking in a bath. And, you know, you could be sitting next to the prime minister. You could be sitting next to a school teacher. You could be sitting next to somebody who's well into their retirement. And everybody's the same in the hot tub.
Exactly.
In Budapest, it's a great equalizer, but it also equalizes everybody up at a higher level because you're in under this palatial dome with, like you said, these lavish mosaics and people just stuffed into their Speedos. And it's just a wonderful kind of crazy luxury.
Well, I do find that there are some places that have a lot of pride in the way that hot springs can be an equalizer, especially in Iceland. A lot of people said, you know, the president of Iceland comes here and he just chit-chats with us in the locker room, just talking with the people that collect rubbish, graphic designers, everyone's here all together. And there is something really special about everyone being the same and able to speak casually.
That may be the appeal across cultures for having this zone where people can be together. So we talked about a palatial hot springs, Greta. Some of them are just a hole in the ground. Tell us about a particularly desolate feeling hot springs that struck you as worth including in your book.
I included a chapter about Nevada's hot springs in the American West, and I feature the only truly wild hot springs. So that means there's no one selling a ticket, there's no staff, there's no dedicated caretaker. So I didn't include the names of the specific hot springs so that they could have a little buffer of protection. And those hot springs are some of the most magical, but they're also among the least reliable. It's possible that you could show up and too much algae grew, or perhaps a herd of wild donkeys wandered through and caused a mess. So I always say that when you visit a hot spring, you are the caretaker of that hot spring for the time being. And that is especially so with the wild hot springs like in Nevada.
That's beautiful. Very important. And you talk about hot springs as a prayer.
Yeah.
And I was particularly struck by the one in India. Can you explain that whole idea of a hot spring?
One of the most striking hot springs in India are two temple hot springs on either side of the Parvati River in Himachal Pradesh. One is Sikh and one is Hindu, and they coexist side by side and share a similar origin story about the creation of the hot spring. But the people that visit each hot spring temple are having a very different internal spiritual experience that is very potent to them. It's a very remarkable and striking experience to visit a temple structure that is billowing with steam, in which people may visit to cleanse their body because that's the most accessible space to have a bath or a shower. And that experience of cleansing their body is sandwiched by a specific type of prayer or spiritual experience.
And what a spiritual environment to have that steam coming out and to have that purification and to be tuned into that as a visitor, to be tuned, not judgmental, but tuned into it and to kind of celebrate and go with it.
Exactly.
Greta Rivas is with us from her home in Portland, Maine, as she helps us understand the unique personalities of hot springs around the world. Greta profiles 23 of her favorites from a dozen countries in her book, Hot Springs, Photos and Stories of How the World Soaks, Swims, and Slows Down. You can view more of her work from a link in today's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. I've always felt, Greta, when I'm enjoying a hot springs, that there's an etiquette. And in fact, a lot of times I'm a little tentative because I'm not sure what the etiquette is.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a very quick review of, you know, etiquette for travelers who are going to experience a hot spring, especially in another culture?
I think the number one rule is to read the room. So if you show up at a hot spring and people that are already there are quiet and not talking amongst themselves, that's typically the best way to proceed. Mm-hmm. Some hot springs feel very energetic and excitable, and it's completely fine to experience them that way. But take a quick temperature gauge of the tone of that space. Go with the local vibe. Similarly, it can feel intimidating to visit a place and not know how much or how little to wear. So looking to see how the locals are dressed can help you feel comfortable.
That's an interesting dimension to it, because I've gone to thermal springs in Germany with German friends, and I turn around and they're naked.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize, well, this is a big shocking thing to me because I'm an American. But for them, it's just, so what? Of course we're naked. We're all naked under our clothing.
Right.
That's a very important thing for American travelers especially to be comfortable with, that in other cultures, they don't giggle, or they don't get overwhelmed with embarrassment, or they don't think it's particularly sexy or anything.
No.
It's just honest with nature. Japan has an even term for it, skinship. What does that mean?
Skinship is a platonic way of being with other people while nude. And so typically that's experienced in a onsen or sento, the two most common types of public baths in Japan. I did hear from a lot of people who grew up with this type of experience, felt a sort of comfort and kinship with their body that I think a lot of Americans might not feel, because we haven't been able to have this relationship with nudity that's not sexualized, that it becomes a lot less scary and more normalized just to be ourselves.
We're exploring the world's thermal waters right now with photojournalist Greta Arribas. She features 23 hot springs in 12 different countries in her book, Hot Springs, photos and stories of how the world soaks, swims, and slows down. You can follow Greta on Instagram under the handle @GretaRibas. I like to talk a little bit about taking the waters. My experience is mostly Europe, but anywhere I've traveled where I've encountered thermal hot springs. Culturally, it's a cure. What's the physiological value, first of all, in the minerals in the water? That's one thing that hot springs have in common. It's geothermal heated water, right?
The way that I think about it is that geothermal water is groundwater that has gone on a bit of a journey. It's gone to an inner part of the earth, and when it came back up, it brought minerals.
Generally, there are minerals,
yeah.
And these are curative in a lot of cases, or at least considered curative.
Yeah, and depending on who you talk to, they're finding medicine in either just the heat or the mineral content or both. I didn't make very many wellness claims in this book. It wasn't quite the goal of the book. But as a person interested in anthropology, I'm interested in the personal experiences and stories about hot springs. And people had a lot of personal experiences about wellness.
Well, even people drink the water. I mean, I've been in spas where everybody lines up to drink the water. It never tastes good, but it apparently people believe it's good for you.
Yeah, in Budapest, someone gave me a steaming cup of geothermal water, and it tasted exactly like I would have expected it to. Heavy, mineral-rich, sulfuric. But a lot of people told me stories often about their grandmother bottling up hot water to bring home to apply to their joints at home.
Well, the first Roman emperors used to go up to Baden-Baden for their rheumatism, apparently.
Yeah.
And outside of London, the town of Bath was, in ancient times, Aquasulis, a place where people went for health reasons. I think what put it on the map was there was a belief that it helped with fertility. And there's the modern situation of a doctor in Germany saying, you need to go to the Black Forest and soak in a hot spring for the next fortnight. What is it with the taking the waters that really makes sense today?
In our lives, we often talk about this feeling of moving too fast. And the antidote to that is to slow down. I think we also often feel a bit of disconnection to nature. And oftentimes we really don't need to do that much to receive the benefits of nature. It's very common that a lot of people feel that there has to be a sense of striving or activity to find a health benefit outside, to climb a mountain, to run faster. But there's something very sweet about just sitting in hot water, be it the water itself or the sense of community that we feel from being with other people or other travelers. Some of the conversations that I had with strangers in hot springs are really memorable. Our phones were away.
That is a huge thing. You cannot have your phone with you in a hot tub. And what you just reviewed, when we think even skeptically about the health benefits of going to a thermal hot springs, slowing down, being close to nature, all of these things can add up to wellness in a frazzled world, can't they?
Exactly.
Greta, I would like to close with one destination hot springs that you'd like to highlight. Where's one place where you can just have an experience that you didn't even know was possible?
I would recommend Ponta de Ferreria off São Miguel Island in the Azores.
Right.
And it is such an exhilarating experience. You climb down metal ladders into a volcanic cove that's cut into the ocean. And what that means is that cool water rushes in with each wave and it sucks out thermal water from the source. So when you're in the water, you feel the rush in of cold seawater and the rush out of thermal water. And then if the waves are high that day, you hold onto the ropes and you can feel your body being moved through the ocean almost like strands of kelp on a line. And most of the time, when I photographed people emerging from hot springs, their faces looked relaxed and calm and quiet. And when people emerged from this hot springs, people looked invigorated, like after going to see a rock band or something, like excitable, thrilled. There was a little element of danger to it all, which is also not something you often experience in hot springs.
So you got danger, you got the exhilaration, and you've got this dramatic setting. This is Ponta de Ferraria on the Azores, that Portuguese island way out in the middle of the Atlantic. And the picture in your book is amazing because it's a volcanic scene. And I suppose you have to get it when the tide is right to get this wonderful tug of war between the heat of the thermal water and the refreshing, bracing coldness of the sea.
Exactly.
And you're just in the middle of that, tossed back and forth.
Yeah. I think that there's something that makes you feel so alive about feeling the contrast between two temperatures. And there's the stark black volcanic rock combined with that foamy, crashing white of the waves. And it's just such a sensory delight to be able to experience all of those things at once.
You know, Greta, this is a great example of how there are so many dimensions of wonder on this planet. And that's the cool thing about your whole passion for hot springs and sharing it with this book. Thank you so much, Greta Rebus. Take care. And I'd love to get, what do you call it when your fingers are all funny after the water?
Pruny fingers.
Pruny fingers. I'd love to get some pruny fingers with you sometime as
maybe in
the Azores. Thanks again, Greta.
Thank you, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You'll find more about our guests at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves Guidebook to Italy has long been America's best-selling guidebook to any destination in Europe. We've just updated it, and it's in its 27th edition, and it's ready and raring to help you turn your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. Pick up a copy at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com.